So the first thing I think is shifting from an audience mindset to a community mindset. Step two is build trust and strategy first, and then monetize later. My third bet is you have to know what your arbitrage is.
I want to know if there's three things that 5 years ago were really valuable in the creator economy and now have lost value.
The first one, I think, which is a no-brainer, is just short form. I think a second one is, and this one, I got to be careful how I say it because it's podcast.
Welcome back to the Creator Spotlight Podcast. My name is Francis Zier, and today we're speaking with Jordan DiPietro. Jordan's career includes a few of the most famous and successful new media businesses out there. He spent 12 years at The Motley Fool, starting as a writer and finishing as VP of Growth, then led The Hustle when they were acquired by HubSpot, and most recently served as the CEO of Hampton, the high-ticket private community Sam Parr founded after leaving The Hustle. He's now writing his own newsletter, Signal Noise, and consulting founders and operators on their businesses. Jordan is a really smart guy, really sharp speaker. This is a really good conversation. I really enjoyed it. I think you will too. So you promised to tell me the three moves that you would bet your next 10 years on as a creator.
Yep.
Walk me through these three moves.
Okay. So the first thing I think is shifting from an audience mindset to a community mindset. And so I think in the last 5-10 plus years, whatever it's been, people have mostly developed very one-sided transactional relationships. So they build an audience and they transact with that audience. They post something on socials to get likes and comments. They have an email list they send emails to. You know, it's just like very one-way and transactional, whereas a community relationship is by nature a lot different. It's more of a, you know, two-way kind of reciprocal relationship. And I think that the more and more people start thinking about this from the very beginning of their business or their, you know, whatever it is that they're starting, I think just the better things are going to be in the future. Because I think we're just moving dramatically away from just impressions for impression sake or reach for reach sake. So I think that's kind of step one. Step two is there was a philosophy that kind of said, build an audience and you can monetize it later. Right. Mm-hmm. So many people, I think, especially in the beginning days of YouTube, especially built huge audiences and they figured out monetization down the road, or they built huge followings on Instagram and they figured out monetization down the road. I don't think that that works nearly as well today, but I do still think that you should build first, but I think that you should build trust and strategy first and mm-hmm. then monetize later. There are way too many people that land in my inbox or that I see building businesses and they're already trying to monetize. Like, I have no idea who you are. I have no idea what your credentials are. I have no idea if I can actually count on you to fulfill on whatever the value prop is that you've shared with me. And it just feels too presumptuous. Mm-hmm. So I feel like there needs to be, you know, there just needs to be more trust built in the initial part of whatever it is. And I think that there's a really easy way to do that. And, you know, I mean, not that my way is the way to do it, but I've been working for 20 years before I've really started to produce content or kind of ask people for any sort of value exchange. But I think that in doing so, right, people know that they can trust me. There's a reputation there and there's trust built up over the years. So I think that's another thing, is not trying to monetize too early. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean just like build an audience blindly and cross your fingers, build a strategy around the future thing that you do want to monetize for, but don't feel like you have to do it right out of the gate.
That's so before you get into the third one, actually, real quick, I want to pause on that.
Yeah.
It's reminding me of something that our mutual friend Matt McGarry said when I had him on, where I forget exactly what I'd asked him. It was something about like if he identifies as a creator, and he said he didn't. And part of why is he said anything he's going to create, any content asset that he's going to put out there, he always has a way to monetize it built in first. There's never content without some sort of monetization attached, though maybe this is where it connects with what you're saying, even if that's kind of down the line and downstream. His newsletter, for example, it's not directly monetized. The monetization is it as a top of funnel for his course and then his agency services.
Right.
So I don't know if that conflicts with what you're saying, but I feel like I talk to more and more entrepreneur type style creators who always have the monetization tied directly to the content. And then I talk to a bunch of more like creative or like sometimes from the journalist world style creators, and they're really just content first. Monetization comes later. It's less attached.
Right. Well, I think it's important to note kind of two things. I do think, of course, like everything, there's different ways to do stuff. But I think you're looking at Matt McGarry, 2025 point in time today, yeah. and what he says he's doing. But I can't remember, God, what year we hired Matt at The Hustle. Let's say it was 2018 or mm-hmm. I don't know, something around there. Something. But, you know, Matt built his chops at The Hustle. Then he went over, I think, post-acquisition at HubSpot for a little while, too. And then he spent some amount of time there, you know, having enough confidence in himself that he knew what he was doing from a paid media to build up newsletters till he went on his own to do the agency. Right. And then he was building the agency and hopefully seeing success with clients that gave more confidence that what he was delivering was of value. And then, so it was a very iterative process. And it's like step by step when you are building trust, right. Mm-hmm. Which was the thing I said, and he was building out his strategy. I'm sure when he started at The Hustle, he had no idea, right. He was going to have an agency and then be doing communities and all this other stuff. But over time he built out trust and he built out a strategy. So then you get Matt McGarry in 2025, who's able to say, oh yeah, everything that I produce has a strategy and a monetization yeah. strategy around it. But you know, I think he would be the first to say, yeah, I wasn't thinking about that in 2018.
Hindsight so is 2020 sort of situation.
Yeah. I think it just takes time, right? You gotta put in the work to get to the point where you can be as intentional as he is. I guess that's kind of my quick take on that.
Okay. So the final thing, the third thing, your third yeah. bet.
My third bet is you have to know what your arbitrage is. So this conversation, I'm going to talk a lot about arbitrage. I think that there are basically three arbitrages as a creator, as a producer, as somebody in content or media. I think there's an attention arbitrage, there's a taste arbitrage, there's a trust arbitrage. Mm. So attention is obviously, you know, impressions, what's your distribution, what's your reach, how many platforms you on, all that good stuff. And if that's your game, if that's what you're great at, virality or reach or whatever, awesome. Then play that fucking game and do that all day long. Trust is different, right? That's a different sort of arbitrage that not as many people have. It's harder. It takes longer. I think it's, you know, it's probably higher value in terms of monetization, but it's a hell of a lot harder to reach. But when people trust you, you have so many different, you really build optionality into your business. You know, I've had people tell me, hey, if you were going to go and launch like a carpet business next week, I would probably just join you. Like that's yeah. crazy because I don't know anything about carpets, but that does tell me that people trust me, which is a nice thing, right? So yeah. it builds a lot of optionality, but it's different. You have to understand what you're good at and what you think your strength is. I mean, this is kind of arbitrage here is basically the same as saying like, know what your strengths are and what your weaknesses are. And then the last one, taste, is, you know, do you have really, really exceptional taste? Are you good at curating things? Do people seem to really care about your point of view? If that is one of the things that you're good at and that you seem to, get respect for in this space, then that's something that you should double down. So I think it's really important to just know from the beginning what you offer, you know, in a unique way and make sure that your vision for your company or where you're spending your time and energy is, you know, directly kind of correlated to which one of those you're kind of going after.
Yeah, I think that's a really helpful framework. On the inverse of this, I want to know if there's three things that you think maybe in the last 5 years or maybe 5 years ago were really valuable in the creator yeah. economy and now have lost value or if they're being given as advice, maybe, you know, it's kind of bullshit. I think, you know, pretty clear in your first item there when you said that community over audience now, it's not, I don't think you're saying that audience is meaningless, but you're sure. saying that like audience for audience sake, maybe 5 years ago was more valuable, now has lost a lot of that value. Yeah. But yeah, the question is three creator economy trends or tactics, okay. strategies, whatever
cool.
that were good 5 years ago that you think are dead or dying now.
Yeah. So this one was, it was definitely easy to think of the first two. The first one, I think, which is a no brainer, is just short form mm-hmm. content in general. I remember when The Hustle was first acquired and we went over to HubSpot and so many people were just talking about short form. And I remember like there's a couple of people in particular kind of in my ecosystem who were incredible at short form video. I mean, really, really skilled at this. But when you would go deeper and say like, what's the business or what's the business model? It's like the business model was short form content. I'm like, that's yeah. actually not a business. You know, that's a type of content on a
platform
specific
ad payouts show. Are not very high.
Yeah. And it's just, yeah. it's not a business. Yeah. It's just, it's, I think what we know now is it can be a great discovery mechanism. Awesome. But it's not a business strategy. Mm-hmm. So I think some of the hype has just died down a little bit from just short form, you know, clips and video content in general. I think a second one is, and this one, I got to be careful how I say it because it's podcasts and I love podcasts.
Yeah.
But if you look at like 2020 to 2022, you know, especially post and during COVID, something like 2 million plus podcasts came on the stage, probably more than that, maybe 2.5 million, something like that. And then if you fast forward to like, I think it was the end of 2024, only I think 90% or more of those podcasts had less than 3 episodes.
Yeah.
It's just, it was so oversaturated and there was so much kind of glut in the market. And so I think the days of like, oh, I'm doing this one thing, I should obviously just launch a podcast or hopefully coming to an end, because it definitely makes discovery harder because there's just so many things out there.
Yeah.
So I think podcasts, not that they're, I mean, it's still one of my favorite channels, period, because it's...
Well, I can speak to this a bit too from my perspective doing this, right? Like, it's hard. I don't know if I've ever said this in public on the pod, but our numbers right now at this moment in time, it's Wednesday, August 13th, as we record this, 2025, we get anywhere from 2,000 to 3,000 listens per week, right? And that's miles better than what we were doing a year ago. I never podcasted before a year and a half ago. Now I've been doing it for a year and a half, and I've gotten much better. And that puts us in the top 10% of worldwide of podcasts worldwide, which is, you know, 2,000, 3,000 listens compared to the newsletter, which right now we're getting 140,000 plus unique opens every issue, right? Like, it's a pretty huge delta, and multiple levels of value here, right? Like, I spent a few hours researching you today. We spend an hour talking, and then we use that to then produce the newsletter. So we're getting value out of it multiple ways. Right. But also, like, this was not a very good product when I started, right? It was kind of like, I'm doing this anyways. Let's invest a little more time, a little more money, and we can put this out. Yeah. And now we put something out that I'm proud of, and I think it's going to keep growing. But like, it's going to take us a while to keep getting there. And we're never going to be my first million, right? I think we'll get more into like kind of your time at The Hustle and the effects there a little later. But I think people saw what The Hustle did with newsletters and what Sam and Sean did with a podcast. And it's like, wow, I want to do that. Right. A lot of people I talked to when I first started doing this actually would bring them up as inspiration, which has been great for podcast, you know, for Riverside, which I love Riverside and I use it to record this, but a lot of those people don't really know what they're getting into. So I think a long way of saying, I agree with you. It's really hard. And it's like, it's not, it, maybe it was easy 10 years ago, you're two guys, you're a couple buddies and you start talking to a mic and you just keep doing it. And then like, you know, suddenly 2020 hits and you get all this attention, but it's those attention hours are so much harder to earn now.
Yeah. I think the two biggest things that you said are, one is like, it really is a labor of love.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to be ready with a podcast to grind week after week, after week, after week. If you take a week or two off or all of a sudden the feed goes dead,
yeah,
like you're kind of done. So it really is. It's a grind.
You got to do it for you.
Yeah. You really have to love doing it and assume nobody's going to fucking listen.
Yeah.
And like, maybe if they end up listening 2 years in, great. The other thing is, it's just like you said, the relationship is that the commitment level is so much higher. For somebody to read your newsletter, all they have to do is take out their phone while they're fucking eating a turkey sandwich, swipe, read quick, boom, done, delete. To take out my phone and listen to a podcast, I have to have a very high degree of confidence that I'm going to enjoy it because it's a commitment. So it just feels they're such, even though people think of them and say, look, oh, they're all different kind of marketing channels. They're so different, but it's also why if it's successful, like Sam and Sean were at My First Million, you know, how many different things that enables you to do afterwards because it is so intimate and, you know, gets you so much trust with your audience. Yeah. But
anyways, I interrupted you. There was one more, you had a third thing to put down after.
Oh, what did we talk about? Short form podcast. Oh, I think I love newsletters. Obviously I've been in the newsletter game for 20 years, but I do think that paid newsletters are going to probably decrease in their popularity. I think it's really, really hard to charge people for just more of the same. I think when you start reading someone's newsletter and you're like, oh, it's a great newsletter. And then you find out like, oh, in order to get this, you know, it's $12 a month, or in order to get two more emails, it's $20 a month. I just think people aren't that excited anymore by just more.
Yeah.
It's also, I think it leads to a lot of burnout with creators because you end up spending a lot of time doing shit that you don't like doing, which is like, oh, I'm writing this piece of content. Should this be my free list or should this be for my paid list? Like, oh, the people that are paying really need more. Now I've got to do this live Q&A. Now I have to do this event. You know, it's, and I just don't think the economies are of scale are there as well. Yeah. And I also just think, I don't know, I just don't feel like people want to continue paying for just a tiny bit more. I think when it comes to certain spaces like finance, investing, tech, business, people are more willing to pay for those things, certainly. But I think in other spaces, it's going to get more and more challenging.
Yeah, I think there's more than two categories for sure. But to really simplify it, I think there's the category where you pay because you just want to support the person. And it's like, I love your work. Put $5 in the tip jar every month, right? And then there's one like Oliver Darcy, Status newsletter, big media reporter, right? He just celebrated a year of his newsletter Status, going independent from CNN. And I was reading the 1 year anniversary thing. What you were just saying made me think of one point in there, which was that the free content does not convert to paid subscribers. But when they have a scoop always spikes their paid subscribers, which again is sort of a business thing. People who are in media read his newsletter to learn more about media. So when you have exclusive information that you're not going to get anywhere else, or you're going to have to wait for it to be waterfalled out because somebody's going to read that and then write about it in their own thing, people will pay for that when it's relevant to their jobs.
Right. It's also, that's harder to sustain, right? Yeah. For him. I mean, that means like, I got to have a scoop every 3 months or else I'm not going to be able to sustain this. And I also think about it in a similar way to, you know, the reason that we have all the streaming platforms that we have today is because everyone got totally sick of cable, right? And you're like, I overspend on everything and it doesn't have all the stuff I want. And so there was a great period where there was like Netflix and HBO, and you were like, cool, this is cheaper and the content's great. Mm-hmm. Now we're in the exact opposite, where I think people are looking and they're like, I pay for Netflix, I pay for Amazon, I pay for Disney, Hulu. Like, there's 9 different things you're paying for, and you're not even that happy anymore with the quality of the content. Yeah. So I think there's like a certain reversion back to the mean, and I feel like that could happen.
As our friend Brian Morrissey likes to say.
Exactly. There could be that in the newsletter space. Like right now, people are like, oh, cool, I'll go follow and pay for my favorite media reporter or my favorite, you know, political reporter or my favorite health person. I wonder how things are going to look when they're paying like 12 different individual people for stuff that used to just be free.
Hey, if you're enjoying this conversation, consider subscribing to the podcast. We release a new episode every Tuesday. All right, back to the show.
But I've been thinking a lot about community engine optimization, which I think I may have just made that up because I don't really think it's a thing. But
forefront of it. You can make it a thing.
I mean, I'm sure my wife will make fun of me later for making some garbage up on the spot. But I do think
that's what podcasts are about.
Yeah, exactly. If you look at how many searches there are right now, you know, across Google, GPT, Snap, Amazon, Meta, right in the hundreds and hundreds of billions per month. Mm-hmm. And as a member and obviously previous CEO of Hampton, I look at what goes on inside the digital community in Hamptons and Slack on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. It's so search driven. And it was just occurring to me the other day that like out of the billions and billions of searches that are happening per day, I know everyone's kind of saying like, oh, it's like, you know, SEO is like, you know, GEO is a new SEO and that's where we should focus, which of course, but I'm also just thinking about what impact will it have when some of the highest value, highest intent searches are all happening inside of communities.
Yeah.
Because if I look inside of Hampton on a regular basis, there's like kind of low level rudimentary searches going on. Like what's the best way to sell a domain, to more transactional things. Like how do I get unblocked from my AWS account, to much more sophisticated things. You know, like how do I set up this ERP in a way that does X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
And that's how these people, some of the most successful tech founders are, that's how they're finding solutions to their problem. They're not searching on Google. They're not looking in GPT. They're looking in their communities first because it has such high trust. And I've just been thinking about that. I don't have like necessarily a takeaway yet because I don't know how it might be monetized in the future or what it means, but something I've been thinking about.
I think this is sharp. I mean, another word for this kind of thing is like dark social, right? Like, which is a term in social media that people use, that social media managers will use for the stuff that you can't find on LinkedIn. You can't find it. Maybe it's in the DMs or it's in the communities. Right. But I think the way you monetize it, like, I don't know how the people who are producing the media monetized it, but the way that you monetized it was with Hampton, which is a high ticket community model, which, let's talk about that for a little bit. So for anybody who doesn't know, the like most summarized to say what Hampton is it's a high ticket exclusive community for people. I think the floor is like you need to be running a business making at least $3 million a year to get in. Maybe that's raised. But Sam, previously founder of The Hustle, founded it. You were the CEO. That was your last job. You left 6 months ago or something as we record this. It's kind of one of the big success stories of this new wave of paid communities. And we've been talking about communities a lot recently on the podcast. I think one thing I've learned is there's kind of two non-negotiables that define a good community. Mm-hmm. Is one, it's people with shared values, shared interests, working towards shared goals, who have kind of a mutual accountability in both contributing to and taking from the community because they're all trying to work towards similar goals. So there's mutual exchange. And then number two is always the in-person aspect. That's kind of like, you can almost say that's more of a negotiable because there are healthy communities that exist purely online, mm-hmm. but it's always kind of like not real until it's real is the thesis I've kind of been building more and more. So tell me anything I missed about what Hampton is, and then I want to hear your take on what are the non-negotiables for this kind of, you know, this buzzword that we now use, right, community.
Right. Oh man, there's so much to go into. You're right about Hampton. Yeah, it's a, you know, private network for founders and CEOs. You have to do at least $3 million in revenue. There's other, you know, criteria as well, but those are kind of the main ones. But I think the IRL piece depends. And it's funny, I can't remember if I told you or not, but I'm writing a report right now in collaboration with The Hustle and HubSpot. So I'm going to go through all this when I release the report. But I think the IRL component really depends on what kind of community is and how much you're charging. Mm-hmm. I think if you have a $200 a year community, you don't have to be doing IRL stuff. If you have a $1,000 a year community, the IRL can feel a lot different than when you're doing a $10,000 a year or $20,000 community. So I think your price point dictates a lot of the format. So I think that's kind of the first thing. I think one of the really, really big things is decentralization. I think that's really, really critical. And that's also really hard. When you start a community, especially, you know, and I'll just kind of talk first person, but when I started at Hampton and, you know, let's say maybe we had 100 plus members at that time, you know, imagine how you would feel if you had 100 plus members, these very, very successful tech entrepreneurs, CEOs, you would want to ensure that the experience was A+. That everything was A+, and that can lead to you being very kind of controlling over the environment, which is a very centralized way of creating the community. But what ultimately happens, besides potentially burning out, is that the community then looks towards you and the company for direction. They don't create their own shared habits, their own traditions. They're not empowered to create value on their own. And the whole reason why communities can be so valuable is if they create excess value for members. So if they can get more value from being in the network, of course, you know, than they can on their own, then it has the opportunity of being an amazing experience. But if you make it all about the team, the CEO, the founder, you know, whatever, it's harder and harder to scale that. At a certain point, it just kind of breaks and it doesn't really flourish. So that was a challenge for me in the beginning, of like how to kind of slowly release control of a lot of things and kind of build playbooks and, you know, build the right systems into the community so that it was more member led than it was like company led. I think that's really important. And one other thing I'll say real quick is from the beginning, really, really, really defining your ICP, you know, your ideal customer profile is super important because you can go into things saying, oh, this is who our, you know, our kind of ICP is. But then just wait until you get people outside of your ICP who want to hand you money. You're going to be like, okay, right?
I like money. Yeah.
I enjoy money. That's why I started this. Let's do this. But what can happen is you end up with a community with a lot of different kind of avatars of ICPs, and then you're trying to serve all of them. So, you know, kind of the most relatable example I can give is, you know, at a certain point in Hampton, we had, you know, bootstrap founders who were maybe doing $2 million in revenue sitting in a room with a public company CEO. Or, you know, a venture-backed founder who just, you know, crossed $100 million in revenue. Like those three people have radically different problems. They have different expectations for what they want and they need. The solutions to their problems are totally different. And so if you're chasing kind of squirrels all over the place, it's going to lead to like feature bloat, burnout, a lot of customer support, and just be kind of a real pain in the ass. So getting crystal clear about like who you're not going to let in as much as who you are going to let in, I think is, you know, really important.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. Again, you need to make sure that like the goals and values are super aligned. One thing that just occurred to me, I hadn't really thought of before, is like the degree to which, you know, this is kind of a trend now and communities are this hot topic, but something like this, like how different is it than one of these like traditional kind of communities, like the Elks or like the Masonic lodges or whatever, like, you know, Harvard, there's like the clubs there, I forget what they are, but you know, all these classic elite communities. And then you get something like this and I'm like, is there any substantive difference? And is it just kind of like, you know, there's the classic joke about like, oh, what if Uber released a product where it's like it can pick up multiple people at once and it stops on these lines and suddenly Uber's reinvented the bus, right? So I guess I'm thinking through this live, I've never thought about it before. Like, is this kind of just the startup version of one of those classic communities where like the axis upon which it like swings and where people gather and what the commonality is this like new like startup founder, tech founder mindset? I don't know. I'm reaching at something and I'm not sure what it is.
Yeah. Tell me if this is kind of, I'm not going to go with the Masonic temple. Cause even though my brother-in-law is in it, I don't know enough about it.
I don't know. To be clear, I don't know too much about any of these specific things. I'm just like throwing in examples of these are old storied communities through which people come together and like, it can be hard to get into them.
Right. So let's use like YPO as a better kind of corollary, right? YPO has been around for kind of 100 years. And it serves a very similar purpose to Hampton. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't want to speak for Joe and Sam, the two current co-founders, but I would say that there's the most revolutionary thing about Hampton as compared to YPO is just the people that we're serving.
Yeah.
Everything else is different around the edges. Like they call them forums, we call them core groups. They're in chapters, but it's all, we're all trying to provide the same thing, which is, you know, member-led peer support.
Yeah.
You know, founders helping each other out, making better decisions, going to events, improving their lives. The reason that they're so different is because of the people that we're serving, you know? So if you look at your quintessential Hampton founder versus your quintessential YPO founder, they look very different. Their businesses are very different. Their age is different. Potentially where they live is different. You know, whether or not they had generational wealth or the type of business model, all these things are all just very different, but the product, the service. So if kind of part of your question is like, are you, reinventing the wheel when it comes to community? Not at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
well, I guess, you entered it correctly. I think I was just trying to figure out like, what is new about this? Like that is what I was wondering. Cause I'm a big believer that there's, you know, kind of no new ideas under the sun. And it's just, you recontextualize things for fresh eyes.
Yeah.
And I think you did get it there. It's just like a specific group of people that wasn't being served maybe by some of these classic communities.
Yeah. The audience is different. And then I also think the reason why it's just a thing right now and why, you know, communities are a buzzword is because you do have a certain amount of people that have gotten, you know, a large following in the last 5-7 years.
Yeah.
And they're looking at what else can I do? How else can I monetize this? Right.
That's
like, you know, it used to be like, oh, I'll launch a software product. That was the obvious thing to do. I'm going to build some sort of SaaS to live on top of this. And now it's just becoming like, oh, I can just launch a community. I mean, I can't tell you, I'm sure we'll talk about it later, but I do, you know, advisory work almost every single week. I have a prospect call me and their literal business is they have built a following on either Instagram, Twitter, or LinkedIn. They're now somewhere between 1 and 2 million in revenue just based off of like content and advertising, and they're interested in building a community. So it's just like, you know, it's just kind of the natural evolution of people reach a certain plateau in their own revenue kind of product journey. And now they're like, oh, sash, mass, let me just launch a community.
And I think, I mean, a clear reason for this is likely like, oh, I saw that Sam Parr did this and now I want to do it. I think, I mean, in the same way I've heard from so many people that they were inspired by the hustle. I think that's probably a pretty direct reason, honestly. Okay. A question about community versus audience. We started this conversation with this. What are some of the most important differences in building? I also, after this, I want to get into your Motley Fool era. Cause I think that's something that other podcasts I listen to you, it always kind of got pushed to the side and you never got to talk about it.
It's my favorite too.
And that's where I want to go. Cause I think that's where a lot of your stuff about building an audience comes from. But before we get into there, tell me a bit about like some of the core differences between audience building and community building as disciplines.
Yeah. I mean, I think community building, like I kind of touched on in the very beginning, is you have to build the systems into place that allow for reciprocal communication. Mm-hmm. So if you're building, you know, an audience-based business, you're throwing up an Instagram account, a LinkedIn, a Twitter account, you're building a newsletter, whatever, and you're not as concerned about bringing people along for the ride. You know, I think one of the things that's really helped in the last 5 years is like the kind of build in public, you know, ethos that's become really popular. That has been great for community building, you know? And so people like, you know, Steph Smith, who's obviously a, you know, a friend and I worked with at the Hustle and HubSpot, like she's done an incredible job of building in public. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, Steph would be the kind of person, if she wanted to go and launch a community in the future, it's such a natural extension because she's already been having these kind of bimodal sort of, you know, relationships with her audience for so long versus someone that's been mostly head down banging out newsletters, you know, for the last 5 years with no kind of two-way relationship. So I think, you know, building in public, getting feedback, you know, putting out prototypes, beta testing, you know, not to, you know, bring Sam up again, but I remember when I was still at the Motley Fool, and he, and Trends wasn't a thing yet. He hadn't built Trends, and he sent me a document through Facebook Messenger because that was like Sam's preferred mode of comms. And it was basically a Google Doc that was a beta version of Trends. Mm-hmm. And he was like, can you just tear this apart for me? I mean, I'd never even met Sam. We had like texted twice or something. Yeah. And so I'm like, sure. But I'm like, that's the kind of mentality that you have. And I don't, at the time, it's not like Sam was thinking, oh, I'm going to build a founder community, yeah, 10 years from now. But that's the kind of mentality you have to want to build in public. You have to want to get people along for the journey. It's just a much different way of doing things than just building an audience.
All the people I've talked to in the past, let's say like 4 or 5 months, who have been successfully building communities, they all are people who really are able to put themselves out there in that way where it's like, we've exchanged 2 texts, but like, I know that you're good at this one thing. Like, I've been able to suss that out. Like, it's very clear to me. Now, here's this thing, like, can you help me out? And it's this very like creating intimacy really quick in a relationship. I think that's really core to the type of person who can build a successful one. Okay, Motley Fool. So you were there for 12 years. I'm gonna read off what was on your LinkedIn here. Okay. Started as a financial analyst, then you were a managing editor, VP of audience development, VP of product, and then you were the chief growth officer for 7 years, long time. And today, correct me if I've got any of this wrong, I think it's been around for 32 years, employs over 300 people, and I believe paid subscription product is still very core to the business. Is that all right?
That all sounds accurate. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
So a few questions here. Yep. One, why do you think this business has been able to survive over these wildly different eras of media in 32 years? It's thriving today, as I understand still. Yeah. Is that like a leadership thing? Is it a strategy thing? Is it just like a product that delivers so much value that it's like unshakable? How has this business survived for 32 years?
Man, that's a great question. Maybe two things. One is, so the co-founders are brothers, David and Tom Gardner.
Oh, interesting.
Tom Gardner was my boss. He's the CEO of the company for a long, long time. Both of them were incredible at adapting and pivoting. And so I believe they started the business in, let's call it 92, 93. Mm-hmm. And they literally began as a chat room in AOL. Like, they weren't even their own business. They were just like a byproduct of a chat room inside of, yeah, AOL.
Well, you could call that a proto community.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's what they were. And they kind of ran the stock market, you know, trend up through 99, and then had a spectacular fall with everybody else in, you know, late 99, 2000. And because they were mostly an ad-based business model. Mm. And I believe they had over maybe 500 employees at that time, maybe more. They had to lay off maybe 80% of them at that time.
I mean, you have to do a lot of layoffs over the last 3 decades in media. You grow and you contract.
You grow and you contract and you adapt. And what they ended up doing, again, I'll get all the dates wrong, but like directionally accurate, is sometime in 2004, something like that, they shifted from an ad-based model to a subscription-based model. Mm. And I still probably think that was the number one greatest thing that they ever did. They shifted their entire model. They also paid off all their VC debt that they had. They became privately employee owned, and they put all their attention and energy into having the best investment picks. So doing that one thing really, really well and delivering that IP directly to subscribers. Mm-hmm. So they weren't reliant on other platforms. They weren't reliant on advertising. They were reliant on subscriptions. And so this was, you know, when I started there, which I think was 2007, 2008, subscription-based businesses, recurring, you know, revenue businesses weren't you know, as popular as they are now. Yeah. But it was incredible what we were, you know, what they were able to do, what we were able to do at the business. I think the other thing is that they didn't get totally distracted by playing other people's games. So I would say that the Motley Fool, you know, and this is obviously a generalization, but did two things really, 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 really well. Investing and marketing. Mm. And those were the two things that I would say we fucking crushed it at. You know, if you came up through the Motley Fool as an investor, I have a very high degree of confidence that, you are a really solid analyst. You understand that space well. And if you came up through the Motley Fool in the years that I was there before me or right after me, you understand direct response marketing. You understand editorial. You know how to, you know, you just know the nuts and bolts of marketing really, really well. And a lot of companies are trying to do lots of different things. And I think, you know, it speaks to certainly the focus of leadership throughout the years to adapt, but also just try to be really good at the things that you're really good at and not kind of go outside the strike zone.
Yeah. One immediate follow-up there is you said that the two things they're really good at, investing and marketing, editorial wasn't in there, but it seems to me to be implied in that the editorial is a vehicle for delivering the investing and yeah. also like is kind of the same thing as the marketing, right?
Yeah. I mean, I knew when I said that was going to be a natural follow-up because it is like, well, that's a separate thing. But at the time, yeah. And it's not that they weren't separate teams. I mean, there was. I came up through the editorial team as a writer. Right. Mm-hmm. So my first job as an analyst was really to write about tech stocks. So I covered like tech stocks, media stocks. So I was a writer. And then after that, I was, you know, managing editor. So there was the editorial team and there was a marketing team and they were different. But you also understood that both of the purposes was to drive people through your funnel. You know, on the mm-hmm. editorial team, it was to get people on the top of the funnel. I mean, that was our entire focus, at least while I was there, was, you know, we created content that was syndicated on Yahoo Finance, MSN, AOL, all those good stuff, and then also SEO. So we were creating really great content that people would find. And then, you know, we were using that content to move people throughout the funnel. So we never really thought of it as being radically different. You know, we were focusing on different points in like a buyer journey, and we all loved investing. That was the other thing. It's like, it didn't matter if you were a copywriter or if you were a designer, or if you were like me, you were originally a writer, like everyone loved investing. And that was one of the awesome parts of being at that company is everybody shared this very geeky, like background of like, no matter if you had a weird liberal arts degree from someplace no one heard of, or you came from a government program, or you came out of an investment bank, like you all loved investing. So that kind of made it like marketing wasn't, you know, sometimes marketing could be like a bad word. It's like, oh, you're on the marketing side of the business, but everyone just loved investing. So it felt kind of like the same thing.
One thing there is like one of my big theses of the creator economy is that it's just marketing all the way down. And like, you know, that can be a different thing than you can be a really good photographer or writer or whatever it is and like participate in the creator economy and almost a little separate. But participation in the creator economy is all about marketing. Gaming, a short form platform to get a lot of views and conversion, that's marketing. Getting people to continue opening your newsletter, that's marketing. And maybe I'm taking a little license with the word, but I think like in the same way that up until a few years ago, the mantra at schools was like, learn to code, learn to code, learn to code. I think with kind of the AI vibe coding era, that kind of shifts to learn to do marketing rolls off the tongue a little less well. But that really lines up with what you're saying. And the fact that you didn't say editorial and you said marketing, I think that is kind of the nature of the creator economy is like, you can write a really beautiful piece with great ideas, whatever, but it's kind of like if a tree falls in the forest, nobody's around to hear it. Right. Doesn't make a sound, right? And I think that's why I say the creator economy is just marketing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, sometimes we used to honestly just call marketing distribution, you know, because that goes to your point of like if a tree falls, it's like, cool, you can create the coolest shit ever, but if nobody finds it, nobody really cares unless you're just doing it for the fun of it. But if we're operating under the assumption that we're all trying to earn a living, then yeah, I mean, I think at the end of the day, you know, I wrote a piece of my newsletter, I think maybe a month ago, that was called like the founder is the funnel. Yeah. And it kind of speaks to, I think if you look at like YC and other venture companies now, one of the biggest things they look at is the founder and whether or not, you know, they're able to.
Bet on the jockey, not the horse, they say.
Yeah, exactly. And I think you see that more and more now. I think it's fortunately or not just as important for founders sometimes to be able to, you know, build trust and be able to get eyeballs. It doesn't have to be all the eyeballs, but the right eyeballs on their content, their product, whatever. So I agree with you. I think whereas it used to be code, 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 and, you know, for a while, engineers were, you know, kind of the rock stars at many places, which I still think, you know, they certainly can be. And I don't mean to diminish that, but I agree that the founder has to be able to wear a marketing hat pretty.
This,
pretty
by the way, it goes back to exactly what you were saying earlier, where, you know, I think you said, like, if a friend was like, if you started like a rug sales business or a rug cleaning business tomorrow, like, I would back you to the hilt, right? It's the same thing. It's just the ability to make things happen, and whether that, you know, in marketing, this distribution, whatever. But yeah, I don't know, a good through line there. I do want to actually get into your newsletter, but one more thing about The Motley Fool.
Yeah.
Let's say you had still been working in media at some other company for those 12 years, but you were not working at The Motley Fool. What would be missing from how you approach your work today? What would you have missed out on by working at a media company or multiple media companies that were not The Motley Fool for those 12 years?
That is an awesome question. I'll give you some props on that. I think the biggest thing was I probably understand database marketing and segmentation better than most people. Mm. I think at a traditional media company, you understand editorial, you might understand distribution, and a lot of times that might be where your, you know, knowledge kind of tends to drop off. But at The Motley Fool, I worked alongside such incredibly smart people who ran our BI teams, our database teams, you know, people that spent years at AOL and National Geographic. And, you know, I'm thinking of a particular gentleman that I learned a lot from who, you know, was the head of data intelligence for the, you know, Clinton campaign decades ago. I'm like, really, really, really incredibly smart people who taught me so much, I think, about database marketing. Yeah.
Mm, that's a great answer. Okay, so your newsletter, it's Signal Noise. To spell it out for anybody listening, it's signal/noise. So you can look it up. What is this newsletter to you? When did you start it? What is it to you?
Yeah. So you can go to jordandpietro.com. It's on there. I started it, I think, late March, early April, pretty much as soon as I stepped down from being a full-time CEO. For years, I've wanted to start doing, you know, producing my own content again. Like I kind of alluded to in the beginning, I started my career as a writer, writing about tech stocks. I've always loved writing. That's always been the thing that brings me the most joy. So when I quit and I stepped down, I kind of started thinking, I wasn't even thinking really about building a business. I was just like, what's going to get me up every day and make me happy? And I was like, writing. So it started as I just wrote a couple blog posts. I threw something up on WordPress. I wrote a blog post or two. And then it was like, oh, people started asking, you know, it's just the classic kind of people said, hey, can you email me when you write your next blog post? You're like, oh shit, I guess I should open up a Beehive account, blah, blah, blah. So it just kind of started naturally and organically, which I think is the best way because it, you know, you can, when you read my newsletter, I hope that one of the things that you know and you feel is that a lot of care, it's not AI, it's me. There's a lot of time and attention put into it. And it's a craft more than it is a business for me. And you know what it's about being a CEO. It's about being a founder. It's about being a parent, a dad. It's about health and family. So, you know, it's all of the things that I'm experiencing in my life as somebody who, you know, was a two-time CEO, spent 20 years in marketing and media, now has two amazing kids and is kind of living life. And I try to share as many stories and insights, and helpful stuff as I can because it's just really enjoyable to do. So,
yeah, I mean, it's a great newsletter. I think I would agree that your voice really comes across in the care. I was rereading, in my opinion, I reread all of them earlier today. Oh, wow. I was in the coffee shop and your newsletter up and to the right, I was genuinely moving. I almost teared up in the coffee shop. Honestly, that's a really good essay. I would recommend that people read it.
Thank you.
One other thing I liked from it that I think is really useful for people that I'll read out here. You were talking about your process and the creative process and kind of what you were just saying about like, it's, I care about the craft, et cetera. You quote some writing advice that C.S. Lewis once gave out. So I'm going to list it here.
Cool.
Turn off the radio, read great books, avoid most magazines, which I think almost today you could maybe avoid short form and read a magazine instead. Yeah. Same thing.
Good. Anyways. Good substitute. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Write with your ear, not your eye. Only write what genuinely interests you. Be ruthlessly clear. Don't throw away bad drafts. Save them. Skip the typewriter. Kills rhythm. and know the meaning of every word you write. So I just thought that was great writing advice, and I wanted to share that.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it. It's been a ton of fun. Ton of fun. I've gotten a couple messages from friends, other founders that are kind of, they'll read it one morning and then they'll send me a message. They're like, this better not just take you an hour or I'm going to be so pissed off because this is so good, blah, blah. And my answer is like, of course it doesn't take me an hour.
Yeah.
Like I literally set aside Monday and Tuesday just to read.
Yeah.
Like those are my 2 days where I literally just, I read and I write and I read and I write. So I'm putting a lot of time and energy and effort into it. And, you know, there's also a part of me, I feel so grateful and so lucky to have had such an amazing career and to have so many opportunities. I mean, so many opportunities when I didn't deserve most of them. So it also feels a little bit like it's just enjoyable to be able to share, help people. You know, so many people respond to the actual newsletter every week, asking me for advice. So it's also a lot of fun.
Yeah, no, I love to hear that. One more thing I want to touch on before we move on is you have another one. Actually, I think it is Up and to the Right, where you talk about sort of the emotional, logical battle when you were deciding to leave Hampton and go out on your own. And I think people should go read that. I don't need to sum it all up here. But I was really thinking about it because I think it was right around the time that we first spoke. This episode's out now. It came out a few weeks ago as we speak. I interviewed this guy named Landon Huslig, who has a local media business in Wichita, Kansas. He shared it, made around 120K last year. He's been doing it for about 8 years. He's been an engineer professionally for the past decade or so. Last year switched to working in philanthropy. But he's got a young family. I think he has two kids. And I was thinking about this because he told me how he's been considering going all in on this for a few years. And he's very confident he can get this up to being a 500,000 a year business pretty quickly. But he just can't bring himself to do it. And, you know, I think for you, you're at least 10 years further in your career than him. I don't know your finances, but you've been an executive for a while. So I'm sure you've got pretty healthy finances. The risk is a bit different for a guy like him, young family, bought a house a year or two ago, I think. But anyways, long preamble for, I'm curious, like what kind of advice you would give somebody like that, who's a bit earlier in their career and maybe they're building something that seems viable, and they're not sure yet if they should leave their stable job for what could be their dream thing, but it's a lot of risk. And I'm wondering what you would give advice, what advice you would give to someone like Landon.
I guess there's two things. The first is that, you know, nothing is without sacrifice. And, you know, there's so much talk about like having the best work-life balance and we should all be, you know, super happy and fulfill every single one of our parts of dreams, et cetera. But like you said, I mean, the only reason I've been able to do what I did is because I worked my ass off for 20 years. I've been super lucky.
Yeah.
And I think it's hard for people to, like, people naturally want to have it all. Mm-hmm. And I just think you have to ask yourself very candidly, like what are the trade-offs I'm willing to make? The process that I went through in the last 6 to 8 months before I left was I was increasingly seeing, because it was hit me in the face, all the trade-offs.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, for the most part, it was time with my kids. I've, you know, a 7 and 10 year old, and it's incredible time. They're awesome. I love being with them. And it was like, man, more and more and more physically I wasn't with them. But then even when I was with them, like mentally, I was just thinking about being a CEO all the time. So it was getting more and more obvious the trade-offs I was making. And it's easy to kind of push those aside and just kind of keep focused. But I just forced myself to really look at those and say, all right, well, how are you going to feel about this? You know, in 10 years, like, what if you have a huge exit and you have a bank full of cash, but you missed like the 5 years before, you know, teenagers when your kids really wanted to hang with you?
Yeah.
Is that going to be a win? Because that's kind of what I was going towards. You know, I'm like, oh, seems fucking lame to me, you know? So part of it is just really asking yourself about the trade-offs you're willing to make and you're not willing to make. And then the other piece of advice I would give is like, I really got caught, like I think a lot of people do, assuming that the way that I was doing something was the way to do it. Mm-hmm. So for me, because I'm actually not a natural entrepreneur, I tend to be a little bit more risk averse. And, you know, having grown up working at companies, it wasn't natural for me to go and do my own thing. And so in my mind, you know, it was like 13 years of the Motley Fool. Cool. Then my next job was CEO. Okay. Then my next job was CEO. And it was like, in my mind, what I was gearing towards was a hopeful big exit. public recognition, you know, making it rain in my bank account, and then we all live happily ever after. And that was kind of how I had structured my life, my dreams, my hopes, my aspirations, my family, all these different things. And it was hard to stop and say, is there actually a different way that optimizes for some different stuff here? Yeah. What if I'm not optimizing for a big exit? What if I'm not optimizing? You know, ironically, you and I are on a podcast right now, but a big part of me was thinking, well, it's fine if I optimize for nobody know who the fuck I am,
yeah.
You know, and it's fine if I just disappear after Hampton, that'll be okay with me. So I just started playing a different game and optimizing for different stuff in my life. And ironically, it's all working out wonderfully. So I also think there's a little bit of like, when you have a passion and a love for something, it's also worth it to take a risk, you know?
Yeah. That classic piece of advice, if you love something, let it go in there. Right. And it sounds like, you know, the things you love of this come back to you. Like, on the podcast side, it strikes me, it's funny. It strikes me that there's sort of a hustle mafia, a la the PayPal mafia, you know, where all these people were involved in it and it became very rich and famous, et cetera. But I'm just thinking, you're on the podcast right now. I've had Matt McGarry on, Adam Ryan, all these people have worked at the Hustle in some capacity. Yep. I almost had Brad Wolverton on. He introduced us, but when I was trying to get him on, he was starting a new job and he didn't need attention on him. Right. A couple weeks before this comes out, Jonathan Hunt, who I've been on the podcast, I think he kind of took the job you had at HubSpot after you left. Similar-ish. I don't know if it's exactly the same.
Yep.
So that he's a little bit separate from that. But all of this to say, it seems like so many, I mean, obviously there's more people involved in the hustle than just the people I listed, but so many people I've wanted to talk to them, obviously, and you yourself included, because you have this great experience that is relevant to the audience. But I think all of you are also good speakers who are game to appear on podcasts and seem to enjoy this kind of work. So I don't know. I didn't really think about that until today.
Yeah.
But I was curious if you have any thoughts on this hustle mafia.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of people that went through that through the team, and I think really, really talented young group of folks who have all gone on to do loads of awesome stuff. And I mean, I could continue listing people, and I keep in touch with almost all of them.
Yeah.
I'll say one of the things that I am most excited about in my 20-year career is kind of this like family tree of sorts of all the different, you know, people that I've reported to and learned from. Like when I was at the Motley Fool, I reported to Tom Gardner, my CEO. On our board of directors was John Mackey, founder of Whole Foods, Kip Tindall, founder of the Container Store. I mean, we had VPs of Google. Like we had such an incredible cast of characters on our board. And then at the Motley Fool, I mean, those people have all gone on to do amazing things. Obviously, you mentioned a lot of the hustle folks. The people at HubSpot are incredible. Now the people at Hampton. So when I think about like building out this family tree of all the people, not just that have reported to me, but that I've worked with, it's just incredible. It's like, I'm so grateful for it. I love keeping in touch with everyone. You know, anytime I get a text from someone that's worked for me, it's like, hey, can you help me think about taking this new job? Or, you know, should I negotiate this salary? It's like, it's just so much fun, man. It's like, it's just about building relationship with people, and life's short. You got to have fun. You got to treat people well and enjoy the ride, you know?
I'm a big believer that every business is a relationships business. And I think that's, I've been trying to say more and more on the podcast to harp on that, like solo creators, whether it's a newsletter, YouTube, whatever, it's like, I think it's detrimental to anybody's career and life, honestly, more than career, to long-term just try to be solo and not work with other people. Maybe, you know, it might take more work or you take a smaller share of whatever revenue you're bringing in. But I think that's something that's kind of lost in this like internet entrepreneur, solopreneur world.
Totally agree.
Yeah. I think that's really important.
I was just emailing yesterday or the day before, I won't say his name, but he's a reader in my newsletter and he also runs his own business. He's in LATAM doing exceptionally well, young guy. And he was like, I'm remote. My team's remote. And he seems lonely as fuck.
Yeah.
And I'm like, dude, go find your team, go hang out with people. Like, you got to get out from behind the screen and it's hard. I mean, that was honestly one of the reasons, I didn't really mention this, but another reason I left Hampton was the team was remote. And that was obviously my doing. I could, you know, if I could go back and do it differently, I probably would. But spending 40 hours a week on Zoom just like doesn't really feel like a way to live your life.
Yeah.
And since I grew up at the Motley Fool where everybody was in an office, you know, and I know the whole office wars is a big generational kind of gap and argument. And I love remote work for lots of reasons. But when I was the CEO, I'd always pictured running a company where everybody would be in the office. And so the long hours and the hard work would be offset by the relationships and the camaraderie and the fun. And man, you can't get that shit on Zoom.
Yeah. Amen. I think we'll stop it there. I had a lot of other questions about your time at the Hustle and HubSpot and the transition there. But I think for anybody listening who really was hoping to get some of that, I think your podcast on Brian Morrissey's The Rebooting Show from a couple of years ago has a lot of that. You also got into some of this with Matt McGarry on his podcast. Maybe we'll have to do a round two at some point. But I wanted to get to a lot of this other stuff that you don't always get the chance to talk about. But this was really good. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you, brother. I appreciate it, man.
Of course. And listener, we'll see you next week.